If you're not counted, do you count? A pretty classic follow the money political story for us today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 27th of March. Good as always to have you here, everybody. We are still 2 years out from the 2020 census, but the economics of the constitutionally required national headcount are very much front and center today. The Department of Commerce, as you know, says it is going to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census, as in, are you a citizen of the United States? The Trump administration says it's asking because it wants to enforce voting rights laws. Others, including several states that are filing suit, say it would scare millions of immigrants, undocumented and otherwise, into not responding to the census at all. Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going with the high price of an undercount.
Nearly 300 programs rely on census data to make sure states get the funds they deserve. Funds for foster care, children's health insurance,
Medicaid, Pell Grants, school lunches.
Norm Eisen is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says in the past, minorities have been undercounted, and adding the citizenship question will make that problem worse.
It means that people will end up having less medical care and less to eat, and it won't only be those who don't answer the census.
He says it'll affect entire communities.
This could be the most failed census we've ever had.
Robert Shapiro is a former Undersecretary of Commerce and helped implement the 2000 census.
It builds geographic bias into the distribution of funds.
Shapiro says take California or Texas, for example. More than 6% of their population is made up of undocumented immigrants. And census data has an impact on business, too.
Little businesses and big businesses use the census data to figure out where to locate stores and what kinds of goods and services to sell.
Andrew Reamer is a researcher at George Washington University.
It's really important to know population characteristics by local area to know what to carry in Walmart.
The final census questionnaire is due to Congress this week. If the citizenship question stays in, it'll be the first time it's been included since 1950. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Any day now, the Trump administration is expected to announce the list of Chinese products it's thinking about hitting with tariffs as a way to punish Beijing for its trade practices. We should say here, the talks between China and the United States on this issue are happening right now, and markets are certainly hoping the two biggest economies in the world can keep their trade issues at the skirmish level rather than all-out trade war. But back to that list here for a second. Of all the, millions of Chinese goods that we import, how does the White House decide which ones to target? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
The U.S. wants these tariffs to be felt in China, but not by the U.S. companies and consumers who buy Chinese goods. That's a bit of a tricky line to walk.
Usually there's going to be somebody who's going to be unhappy.
Bruce Hirsch is a former assistant U.S. trade representative.
The challenge is to minimize that unhappiness, minimize the harm, and still maintain the leverage.
That might mean picking Chinese products that are also available from other countries, so consumers still have tariff-free options. Steve Koh is a partner with the law firm Akin Gump.
Typically, you would look at the products that matter the most to the country, products that have either some legitimate economic significance or some sort of symbolic significance.
U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer said on Capitol Hill last week that his agency has developed an algorithm to help identify potential products. He also had a few suggestions to add to the list, areas China's targeted for development by 2025.
Aerospace and aeronautics equipment, maritime equipment and high-tech shipping, modern rail transport equipment.
When the U.S. does release its list of products, it'll just be a draft, says Jeffrey Schott with the Peterson Institute.
So that's when the fun and games begin, because every lobbyist in town will then proceed to argue why certain products should be on or off the list.
That review period also gives the two countries time to try and work out a deal to avoid tariffs altogether. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, stocks were terrible, oil was down, bonds had a rally, but that does not mean what you think it means. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While it's not yet clear whether Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is going to testify before Congress of his own volition, CNN reported today the company is strategizing about possible testimony. But Zuckerberg did say thanks, but no thanks this morning to the British Parliament's Media Committee, offering to send deputies instead. We've called Stephen Beard in London to get some context on the European part of this story. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So quickly, what is this committee, looking into?
Data mining, data manipulation, and fake news. It invited Mark Zuckerberg to appear after the allegations surfaced about the 50 million Facebook users whose data had been abused and exploited during the U.S. presidential election. The committee, in fact, had invited him to appear twice before and been rebuffed, so it can't have been that surprised by rebuff number three. Nevertheless, the lawmaker who chairs the committee said he was absolutely astonished that Zuckerberg was refusing to appear given the seriousness of the allegations, and he urged the Facebook boss to think again.
Do you think Zuckerberg has anything to lose by not getting on a plane and going over there?
Well, they can't force him.
Yeah.
He could be declared in contempt of Parliament, and he might then have to reason with an official in stockings called the Black Rod. However, he's not a British citizen, so he can't be compelled. In reputational terms, I suppose it's a little damaging, but he's already suffered a lot of reputational damage on that side of the pond. It's interesting, this, because Rupert Murdoch, also not a British citizen, was once summoned to appear before a parliamentary committee over the phone hacking scandal. He actually did turn up, but he got a bit of a mauling, actually, and as it happens, a protester threw a cream pie at him.
I remember that.
Not a happy experience.
Yeah, but to that end, right, of Zuckerberg clearly wanting to be able to do business both in the UK and in the wider European market, what are the risks of, in essence, by thumbing his nose at the Brits, does he risk more swift and substantive regulation of Facebook and all the rest?
Tougher regulation is already on its way. The UK information regulator is going to get additional powers very shortly. A new EU-wide data protection law comes into force in May with multi-million dollar fines for companies that don't adequately protect data. So the screws are already tightening a bit on Facebook. The bigger threat, I imagine, is the threat to its business model, whether advertisers do shy away from the platform because of fears of a consumer backlash. Right. No major signs of that, however, in Europe yet.
Stephen Beard at the European Desk in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
One of the things the big Trump administration push for deregulation means is that a lot of the laws that led to those regulations are getting another look. One case in point is the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA as it's known, a 1977 law that was in part meant to prevent banks from redlining, refusing or limiting lending in low-income or minority neighborhoods. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains, a lot has changed in banking in the past 40 years.
Fed Vice Chair for Supervision Randall Quarles says it's time to improve the rules for the Community Reinvestment Act, the CRA for shorthand. For one thing, banks aren't the only ones lending anymore. Jesse Van Toll is with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
We had the rise of independent mortgage companies, which are not subject to CRA because the letter of the law refers to taking deposits, and CRA is very much based on branch networks.
But with the rise of new financial technology, fintech, online lenders and banks may not have branches in the neighborhoods they serve. Or don't serve, says Mersa Baradaran, a University of Georgia law professor who studies banking.
It certainly is still the case that black and brown communities in formerly redlined areas are getting subpar credit. Whether that comes through a fintech lender or a bank, it's all the same.
But brick-and-mortar banks have to adhere to all the CRA rules, which can include investments in affordable housing and careful tracking of lending to minority groups. Carolina Reed studies city and regional planning at the University of California, Berkeley.
The question in my mind is, are they talking about modernizing the CRA or are they talking about weakening it?
The process to update the CRA rules will be lengthy, she says, and banks, housing advocates, online lenders, and others are already weighing in. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We've got some good news for government agencies, and we've got some bad news for government agencies. The good news is that the president has signed the $1.3 trillion spending plan funding the government through September. The bad news is that the president has signed the $1.3 trillion spending plan funding the government through September, which means there's a whole lot of money to spend and not a lot of time to spend it in. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
It takes Congress a lot longer to finish its budget process than it used to. Steve Ellis is with Taxpayers for Common Sense.
The last time Congress got all the spending bills done on time was in the late 90s.
This gives federal agencies very little time to spend their budgets, just 6 months this year. If they don't spend everything, Congress takes the money back.
The law right now says that you have to use it or lose it.
That's Henrietta Trays of Veda Partners. She says this leads to a frenzy of federal spending at the end of each fiscal year in September. Trays says at the end of fiscal 2017, the State Department restocked its liquor cabinet.
The State Department spent something like $80,000 on cocktails at 10 different American embassies.
The Department of Health and Human Services spent more than $2 billion on armored vehicles. These spending totals are from OpenTheBooks.com. And this year, Congress decided to bust through spending caps, giving federal agencies an extra $143 billion to spend at the last minute.
It is rare to see this huge bump in money so late in the year, I think.
Justin Bogie is with the Heritage Foundation. He says last month, Congress created a new bipartisan committee to come up with a better way, like doing a budget every other year or moving the start of the fiscal year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Vouchers would be the solution pretty much to homelessness.
Would that there were enough of those vouchers. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so this was a little crazy today. The Dow Industrials was up 243 points at one point, ended down 344, 1.4%, 23,857. NASDAQ off 211, that's 2.9%, 7,008. The S&P 500 lost 45 points, about 1.7%, 26,12 there. General Electric, GE, sparked 4.2% higher on speculation that Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett is going to buy a stake in that company. Neither Buffett nor GE has confirmed. Berkshire Hathaway shed 1.6%. Twitter dropped 12% on data and privacy fears. Speaking of which, oh look, Facebook down another 4.8% today. Bond prices rose or rallied is what I said. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.77%. Remember, the Federal Reserve wants interest rates to be going the other way. The market, however, differs. You're listening to Marketplace. You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The room where it happens. How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just sing like a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Pause for a moment here with me to consider some recent big economic policy points. The steel and aluminum tariffs, whenever they may come into effect. The GOP tax overhaul, better known around the White House, you might remember, as the president's cut, cut, cut plan. Both of those and many others are issues where politicians and economists were not saying or thinking the same thing. Alan Blinder is a professor of economics at Princeton University. He's got a new book out called Advice and Dissent, in which he is trying to get those two groups, politicians and economists, on the same policy page. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks. Nice to be here.
I have to say, as somebody who believes in both of these items in your subtitle, Why America Suffers When Economics and Politics Collide, actually all three items, economics, politics, and America, it's a bit distressing, as is this book.
It is a bit distressing. And, you know, economists could lean a little bit more political, by which I mean not partisan, but savvy.
Yeah.
And politicians could pay a little bit more attention to facts and logic and basic economics. You know, it doesn't quite have to be a meeting of the minds, but a little better communication about what's good economics without any illusions on the economist's side that the politicians are always going to choose the correct economic answer. But we're kind of politically naive, and you need to understand the constraints under which the politicians operate.
So, you know what's interesting about that, saying that economists are politically naive? You're a guy who, just to get this out there, right, and you say it in the book, you're a Democrat, you served in Bill Clinton's National Economic Council, but you do start this book, or early on in the book, is a scene with you, and then I guess he was president-elect at that point. You get down to Little Rock, and you have your first sort of interaction with that mechanism.
I have the phrase in there jokingly, it's a new world, Tevye. It wasn't a world I was accustomed to then. I was a young man then. It was a long time ago. But it operates under strange rules, strange to an academic, and a very different sort of logic, which I call in the book political logic, to distinguish it from, say, Aristotelian logic, the kind of things we teach in universities.
Explain that a little bit, would you?
One example is what you were just alluding to before. Politicians get elected, except for the president, politicians get elected by somewhat narrow constituencies. And even the president is catering to a variety of interest groups. That can lead them, for example, to favor policies that shower large benefits on a tiny but politically active minority, even though it's at the cost of a huge number, tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of people. Take the TPP. The TPP would have given tiny, tiny benefits to millions and tens of millions of Americans, but it would have exacted costs, sizable costs, on a small number. The large number says nothing to their politicians. I mean, who is going to be activated politically by a few dollars? The steel tariffs, another great example. It's in front of us right now.
Go ahead. Tell me more, because it is in front, and it's been in the news.
There are a small number of steel companies and a relatively small number of steel workers. They are not wrong to favor these tariffs. They're not foolish. But if you stack that up against the vast number of businesses and consumers, each of whom will lose a tiny little bit, the sum total, if you add it all up, is extremely skewed, as it's been in the media recently, towards the anti-tariff position. But by political weighting, the skewness, if anything, goes the other way around.
Okay, but here comes the pushback then, because you get economists involved in this, and they say, look, this is about market efficiency, and this is about the long run, and this is about transition costs. And of course this happens, and we'll be better off in the end. And politicians are like, are you out of your mind?
Yeah, and I think we are out of our mind when we make the arguments only on those grounds. Again, not that we're wrong, but you need to understand the political backdrop. In politics, efficiency doesn't matter so much, but fairness matters hugely. So we could make some of those arguments on fairness grounds more than we do. Secondly, I think you started about in the long run.
Yeah.
This is one of my pet peeves.
Yep.
You know, the long run for economists could be measured in decades. Go try to tell that to a politician who's standing for election in 6 months or even 2 years. And then you mentioned, Kai, and last, my real pet peeve for my fellow economists.
Yeah.
I'm on a one-man campaign to get the term transition cost banned.
How's it going for you?
Well, I have some hopes for this book. We'll see. But not so well so far. I mean, if you take the case – let's go back to steel.
Yeah.
A 55-year-old steel worker who loses his job in a steel mill – he will never get a job. He will never get a job in a steel mill again. He probably won't get as good paying a job as the one he lost. And if we keep wailing these are only transition costs, they're going to think we're crazy.
Yeah, and they're going to stop listening to you, right? You'll get shut out of the debate.
Yeah, completely. They already are.
So this is a little bit of a downer to end on, but I guess I began on a downer too. It sort of seems like economists and politicians in varying degrees are failing the country.
Well, I think they are, and that's indeed the motive for writing the book. I do end the book, Kai, on somewhat optimistic notes.
Yes, sir, you do.
Not to be a Pollyanna, but making a few suggestions for – I call them palliatives. We're not going to cure this problem. Right. This is a problem that you try to manage rather than cure. And I think there's room for improvement.
Alan Blinder is a professor of economics at Princeton University. He has served in the Clinton White House. He's also served on the Federal Reserve, so he knows whereof he speaks. Professor Blinder, thanks for your time, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Kai.
We started today with the census, the actual enumeration of the people living in this country. Often missed in that formal count are the homeless in America, a population that ticked up last year for the first time since 2010, led in large measure by a 26% rise here in Los Angeles County. Meanwhile, the federal government's main tool to subsidize housing for those who can't afford it, what are known as Section 8 vouchers, are in short supply. Just one in four people eligible for that rental subsidy nationwide actually get it. And with years-long waiting lists in most cities, local partnerships are trying to fill the gap. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
When Los Angeles opened its Section 8 waiting list for the first time in a decade, Eliana Cortez was hopeful. She applied. So did most of the 150 women sharing a floor with her in a Skid Row homeless shelter. But unfortunately,
none of us got approved. None of them got the lottery. Nope. You know, it's just sad that everybody's really depending on this.
We talk on the busy sidewalk outside the 11-story Weingart Center in the heart of the densest concentration of homeless people in the country.
I call it temporary displacement. That's all it is to me.
Cortez is 31. She's a tattoo artist, but she's been out of work and on the street since her accident about a year ago.
I got hit by a car. I was in coma for almost a month. My second home is a freaking hospital.
Cortez gets general relief from the county, $200 a month, and does freelance tattooing. She doesn't make enough money to afford rent, so here she is.
I really got to stick it out, live in these dirty conditions, hepatitis going around, I'm scared, eating these leftover foods.
Cortez is getting help at the Weingart. She actually just got a voucher, not through the normal Section 8 process, but through a county program that subsidizes housing for homeless people who use a lot of county health services. Just like with Section 8, she'll pay 30% of her income for a fair market rent apartment, and the rest is covered.
So now I just look for a property that'll take it.
L.A. County's Housing for Health director, Mark Trotz, says the program has housed 4,000 people in the past 5 years.
If you want to house a homeless person, they need a rent subsidy and support services. And it's not necessarily as complicated as everybody tries to make it.
He says this approach actually saves money. For every dollar invested, the county government saves $1.20 in health care and social services costs, according to a study by the RAND Corporation.
People will sometimes blanch about the notion of potentially a lifetime subsidy, but when you compare it against the human cost, the financial cost of leaving people to essentially die on the streets, the cost is inconsequential.
Last year, L.A. voters passed a measure that set aside more than 30% of the city's Section 8 vouchers for the homeless. But to make up for the shortage, the county started its own local low-income subsidy pool with $4 million from the Hilton Foundation.
You can advocate on the federal level for Section 8 budgets of the past, but they're not there now, and we've got tens of thousands of people living on our streets.
Trotz says the local subsidy is more flexible than Section 8, which requires drawn-out inspections and rejects applicants who are undocumented or have serious felonies. This way, with a caseworker's help, homeless people can get into rental units faster. There are more than 60 local low-income rental assistance programs across the country. Peggy Bailey at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities says they're useful, but
they can't replace federal housing vouchers. Most of them are small and aren't meeting the scale of the need either.
The needs are growing because housing prices are rising, says Nan Roman. She runs the National Alliance to End Homelessness.
We've moved from a nation which had a surplus of housing units that were affordable to poor people to one that has a deficit.
She says there are three times as many low-income households that need rental housing than there are affordable and available units. You could fix that on the supply side by building more affordable housing or the demand side.
Vouchers would be the solution pretty much to homelessness, but there are not enough vouchers because there's not enough money invested in the program.
In last week's Down to the Wire budget deal, Congress did approve spending more on HUD and Section 8. The budget is expected to provide 60,000 new vouchers nationwide. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that Easter is this Sunday, and also that sometimes what sounds like a bad idea really is a bad idea. From the pages of the Dallas Morning News, this item: the Collective Brewing Project in Fort Worth has made what I guess you would call a seasonal beer: vanilla, butterfly pea flower, and 30 boxes of Peeps. Peeps. Said the head brewer, quote, "Several of us were just sitting around the brewery talking about how beer has become this super serious thing. I've been on a kick to assert beer should be a fun thing." I mean, I hear you, man, but Peeps? All right, we got to go. From the highs to the lows today, the Dow Industrials closed down 344, 1.4%. NASDAQ off 211, 2.9% there. Thank you, tech. S&P 500 lost 45 points, about 1.7%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.